At last, we've arrived at the lecture you've all been waiting for, lecture number 28 for Old Testament Survey, Study Pack 14B. As we enter the last lecture of our Old Testament Survey, we see that there are great changes that have come upon the international setting in which the nation of Judah finds itself. The Assyrian Empire, which had the military control from the area of Thebes, which was 500 miles up the Nile River, disintegrated with the fall of Nineveh around 612 BC. With that fall came the rise of the Babylonian Empire, which destroyed Jerusalem in 586 BC. In this lecture, we'll be covering some of the last prophets of the Old Testament. We're starting this morning with Zephaniah. Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 1 gives the only information we have on this prophet. We know that Zephaniah's ancestry is traced back four generations, indicating that he was a man of prominence, even of royalty. He was apparently a great-great-grandson of Hezekiah, and as such was the Old Testament prophet with the highest social standing of any of the prophets. It seems as though he prophesied from Jerusalem, with his reference to this place in verse 4 of the first chapter. Zephaniah probably prophesied after the law was found by Hilkiah in the temple, since he implies that there was a great religious revival that was taking place with the cutting off of the remnant of Baal worship. Apparently, he prophesied when the king's sons were old enough to dress wearing foreign apparel. They were able to make their own choices of what they wanted to wear, and they were wearing foreign apparel. He used frequent quotations of the law. And, of course, that's the indication that points that it was probably after the law was found by Hilkiah in the temple. But he also gives a message of impending judgment, which is appropriate for those who would reject religious revival under King Josiah. His prophecies can be assumed to have been received after Josiah's revival in 622, but before the destruction of Nineveh in 612. For he indicates that Nineveh was still in existence in Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 13. Zephaniah prophesied about the desolation of the nation of Judah. It's been said that the prophecies of Zephaniah are a summary of all the Old Testament prophets. After the death of King Hezekiah, Manasseh and Ammon had reigned, greatly increasing the sins of Judah. When Josiah came to the throne, the kingdom was in a state of moral and spiritual degeneracy. And you can imagine, I look back and see once what happened in the years of the Clinton administration and how wickedness greatly increased in our nation in that short span of 8 years. When you stop and think that Manasseh was king for 55 years and did that which was wicked in the sight of the Lord, you know that there was a whole bureaucracy that had been established that was just filled with wickedness from the top to the bottom. And so the 31 years of the reign of Josiah did not necessarily turn all that around. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king and reigned for 31 years. He was 18 when the revival began. And so there were some changes, but not all of the changes were for real. We find that Zephaniah says in chapter 3, verse 3 and 4, "Her princes within her are roaring lions. Her judges are evening wolves. They gnaw not the bones till the morrow. Her prophets are light and treacherous persons. Her priests have polluted the sanctuary, and they have done violence to the law." This first chapter shows the coming desolation of Judah because of her Baal worship and the worship of the host of heaven upon the housetop. Outwardly, idolatry had been destroyed, but the hearts of many of the people had not been reached by the revival that took place. While the worship of Jehovah was reestablished, idolatry was not entirely removed from Judah. The black-robed priests of Baal were worshiping with the priests of God. It was popular to relate the worship of the God of Israel to the worship of other gods at that time. And so while they were worshiping other gods, they were talking about the God of Israel. As a result, 11 times Zephaniah calls this day the coming wrath of Judah, the great day of God. The great day of God. The day of terror that was about to break upon Judah definitely refers to the Babylonian invasion and Judah's captivity. In his second chapter, Zephaniah has a prophecy of the judgment of the nations. He predicts judgments upon the four cities of the Philistines, upon the Moabites, the Ammonites, Ethiopia, which of course was southern Egypt, whose rulers controlled all of Egypt at that time. He also predicted judgment upon Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. The prophecies of Zephaniah were all fulfilled, with Philistia becoming uninhabited and never rising to power again. Zephaniah's prediction that all their land would revert to the Jews was fulfilled when the remnant of the Jews returned from Babylon. Since this land was given to the Jews under the Abrahamic covenant, it would not continually remain uninhabited. In his third chapter, Zephaniah arraigns Jerusalem, rebuking her for her sins, arguing that the total destruction of her neighbors should have brought Israel to repentance. But Jerusalem refused to repent, becoming so corrupt that God had to judge her. Zephaniah, of course, concludes with a prophecy of future restoration and blessing for the Jews. He speaks of a remnant being saved three times. And he addresses their return from captivity twice. He also speaks of the introduction of a pure language to the earth after he gathers the nations together to pour out his indignation. His prophecy closes with the promise of the future restoration, with the chosen people being saved, gathered, and restored. In chapter 3, verse 20, he says, "At that time will I bring you again, even in the time that I gather you, for I will make you a name and a praise among all the people of the earth when I turn back your captivity before your eyes, saith the Lord." And so restoration is not only promised, but also an undoing of all who afflict Israel. Now, I'm not sure if we're all going to speak Hebrew when we speak a pure language on the earth or what we're going to speak. But we are all going to speak the same language once again. It is going to happen once again. And, of course, the diversion of languages that we have and the diversity of languages that we have in this world comes because of the fall of man and the wickedness of man and God having to spread man throughout the earth. And so he divided the languages at Babel. We look next at the prophet Haggai. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi were all prophets who belonged to the period after the return of Judah from captivity. In 536 BC, Cyrus, the king of Persia, issued a decree allowing the Jews to return to their land to rebuild their temple, concluding the 70-year captivity predicted by Jeremiah. The prophecies of the post-exile prophets dealt with the reestablishment of the Jews' national life in their land. Both Haggai and Zechariah prophesied about and aided in the rebuilding of the temple under Ezra, while Malachi was associated with Nehemiah in the rebuilding of the walls of the city. As we look at chapter 1 of Haggai, we find that it deals with the construction of the temple. One of the first exiles to return under Zerubbabel the governor and Joshua the high priest was the prophet Haggai, one of the first exiles. Haggai delivered four messages from the Lord to the returning Jews. The first message is dated in the second year of the reign of Darius and is very clear. It was time to rebuild the house of the Lord. Soon after that, they began building. The Samaritans, who were jealous of the returned Jews, stopped the building. Their opposition lasted until 521 BC, during which time the returned exiles grew more interested in building their own houses instead of God's house. They're very similar to the way people are in the United States today. They were worried about financial depression. You know, things weren't going so well in the homeland. You stop and think, they come back into the homeland and they bring back 50,000 Jews. How do you think business is going to be in comparison to what it was before they went into captivity? And so they're concerned about depression. They use it as an excuse for their neglect in rebuilding the temple. It's interesting because last year we went into a financial recession in the United States, and what do we find? We find that giving to nonprofit organizations dropped in the United States. Why? People are concerned more about their own well-doing than taking care of others. And so the United States is not any different than the Jewish people. Haggai challenged the people of his day to set their priorities. If they would put the things of God first and rebuild the temple, financial and spiritual blessings would follow them. The rebuilding of the temple, of course, resumed through the encouragement of Haggai and the prophet Zechariah. The number of Jews living in the land, of course, once again was very low, and so they didn't have a lot of resources to purchase material, and they were unskilled in building. As a result, the Jewish people were pretty discouraged in building of the temple. Nevertheless, Haggai prophesies that there's going to be a greater temple. The Jews had lived for the last 70 years without a temple and without temple worship. Because they'd lived so long without it, they didn't really feel an urgency to rebuild. You know, what you don't know you don't have, you usually don't miss. Until I got a PDA, I didn't know how much I missed it. Once I got one, then I found out how much I missed it. And so, if you don't know, you don't really miss it. And yet the Israelites did miss. You know, just because you don't know you're missing something doesn't mean you aren't missing something. And so the Jewish people were the very same way. Nearly a month and a half after his first prophecy, the building of the temple had resumed. No doubt this was a time of discouragement, a time of very, very slow progress, because you had all of the rubble of the destroyed temple, and the last 70 years' worth of rubble had to be cleaned up as well. Haggai begins by reminding the Jews that God has not left them alone. In Haggai chapter 2, verses 2 through 4, we read these words. "Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and to the residue of the people, saying, Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory, and how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts." Now, God didn't just tell them just to be strong. He also said work. You know, sometimes in the Christian life, we want to be strong, but we don't want to work. No, if we don't do the work, it's not going to get done. Haggai asked three questions, which are basically rhetorical questions. Who among you saw the first temple? His second question was, how do you look at this new temple? And his third question was, does it look like nothing in comparison to the old temple? Similar questions had been asked at the laying of the foundations of the temple under Ezra, and apparently there were a few left alive who had seen the temple before its destruction. Haggai goes on to assure them that the glory of the latter temple would be greater than the glory of the first temple. This would be difficult for those who may have seen Solomon's temple in 586 BC to understand. Unquestionably, Haggai's view extends beyond the rebuilt temple to the day in which the millennial temple will be in Jerusalem and the desire of all nations shall reign. In Haggai chapter 2, verses 21 through 23, we read, "Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen. And I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them, and the horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, will I take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, saith the Lord, and will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts." We have here a message from Haggai, a message that is spoken to the governor of the Jews, Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel belonged to the royal line. He belonged to the royal line. And his name can be traced through the genealogies of Christ in both Matthew 1 and Luke 3. It's clear. God promises to overthrow the nations, but would preserve his chosen people and place a member of the royal family of David on the throne in Jerusalem. The signet ring is a sign of authority, and Zerubbabel is pointed to as a representative of Jesus Christ. As you look at the four messages of Haggai, you'll find that each one of his messages is dated. It shows us that he spent 4 months giving these particular prophecies. He's quoted in Hebrews chapter 12 in regard to the shaking of the heavens and the earth as well as the nations. And of course, this is a reference to both the physical and political upheaval that is going to take place before the second coming of Christ. We move on to the prophet Zechariah. Zechariah is a very intriguing person. His prophecies are very extensive. He was a contemporary of Haggai, serving with Haggai in the encouraging of the Jews and building the temple. He was probably much younger than Haggai, since he was the grandson of Iddo who returned from the captivity. Of course, you remember that Haggai returned from the captivity, but this is the grandson of Iddo who returned from the captivity. When comparing the books of Haggai and Zechariah, it becomes evident that Zechariah confirms the words that are spoken by Haggai. But you'll find in comparing their prophecies that the prophecies of Zechariah extend further and are more complete than those of Haggai. He gave the small remnant of the Jews in the Promised Land a vision of the greater restoration that was going to take place centuries later. As at other places in Scripture, Haggai's ministry was primarily concerned with the temple and the religious life of the people, while Zechariah dealt with the nation and its political future. We know that Haggai started prophesying about 2 months before Zechariah. And so the first prophecy of Zechariah, you'll find, takes place 2 months after the first prophecy of Haggai. He begins by going back in history to the forefathers of the remnant in Israel, reminding the people of their failure to follow the Lord. You know, sometimes we need to be reminded, too, of things that we've blown in the past, just to remind us that we need to go in the right direction instead. He uses the phrase, "Thus saith the Lord," at least 89 times out of the 1,904 times that it is found in the Old Testament. Zechariah very, very clearly and explicitly claimed that God had given him the message that he was passing on to the people of Judah. The book of Zechariah is considerably larger than the book of Haggai. The period of time covered in the prophecies of the book of Haggai are 4 months, while the prophecies found in the book of Zechariah cover a period of time of about 2 years. Undoubtedly, for both of them, their ministries lasted longer than the covered time in their prophetic books. Zechariah's opening message begins somewhere between Haggai's second and third messages. At that point, that work on the temple was just a little bit over a month along, and its apparent insignificance was disheartening to the people. I don't know about you, but I've worked on different jobs where you've started out with something where it was just an absolute disaster. And when you first start out on it, it is disheartening because you're cleaning up everybody else's mess to begin with. Well, that's the way the children of Israel felt as well. And so they were disheartened. And yet Zechariah comes to them and gives them words of encouragement instead. He warns them to not go back to their wandering ways in the past that had brought them to the state of disrepair that their nation was in. He presents visions that are given by God to encourage the people with the glory that is yet to come in the future. Granted, that glory is far off in the future, but there is a glory to the children of Israel that is coming in the future. And it's significant that almost every one of these minor prophets who talks about the destruction of Israel, who talks about the destruction of Judah, also talks about the restoration and the promised restoration that God gives them. So we look at Zechariah's visions. The book contains 8 symbolic visions. It seems as though the visions came one after another and were written down at the time in which they were given. God's messages generally come by the moving of God's Spirit upon the minds of the prophets. But Zechariah received his messages through an angel who talks back and forth with him. The first vision that we're going to look at is the vision of the myrtle trees. Zechariah saw a man sitting upon a horse in the myrtle trees. Now, the myrtle trees usually grew in the low places. Behind him were red and white speckled horses. Boy, I was just about ready to say red, white, and blue speckled horses, and I knew that wouldn't come off very well. There were red and white speckled horses representing those who God sent to and fro across the face of the earth. When he was asked about the 70-year captivity of Israel, and when God's favor would be restored to Israel by the angel of the Lord replied to him, and he passed that message. That man passed the message on to Zechariah. He passed on a message then indicating that God was very displeased with the heathen who had caused the problems for the Jews, and that both the temple and the city would be restored once again. And so we find a message that verifies what we've seen in other places as well. God's displeasure upon the heathen. We've seen other minor prophets that are displeased because they're looking and they're saying, wait a second, you know, why are you using the wicked to destroy the Jews? They're worse than we are. But we see God's displeasure upon those that are used as an instrument of chastening just as well. And so we find that same situation coming to pass here. In Zechariah 1, verses 14 through 17, we read, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they helped toward the affliction, forward the affliction. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies." That's what Zechariah was looking for. "I'm returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it, saith the Lord of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem." In other words, the city's going to be rebuilt. "A line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry yet, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, My cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and the Lord shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem." And so we find the ending of the very first vision. The second vision is a vision of the horns and the carpenters. In chapter 1, verses 18 through 21, we find in this vision that the four horns represent the four world empires. Those four world empires had been instrumental. They had destroyed Israel and Judah. And the four carpenters represent God's destroyers of those nations. It was God's way of telling the Jews that the prevailing world powers would be broken. And Judah would once again be exalted. It's God who's on the throne, who's mightier than the great world powers, even when his people are temporarily vanquished from power. We can see even today, in the political structure, even in the United States, when those who are unrighteous are put in power, we find that God can still override them in many different ways. And it's just really amazing to be able to see those things happening. Next, we have a vision of the measuring line in chapter 2 of the book of Zechariah. This vision speaks about a greater Jerusalem with a vast population whose suburbs extend far beyond its walls. It's not difficult for those of you who have already been in Jerusalem or already been to Israel to imagine that. I don't know. How many of you have been to Israel? Okay. Well, we've got a few here that have been to Israel. I highly recommend it because there's so much that you learn and so much that you understand. But even now, when you go to Jerusalem, the vast majority of Jerusalem is outside the walls. Jeremiah also called attention to this in Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 38 to 40. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that the city shall be built to the Lord from the tower of Hananiel unto the gate of the corner. And the measuring line shall yet go forth over it against upon the hill of Gerab, and shall compass about to Gaoth. And the whole valley of the dead bodies and of the ashes and all the fields unto the brook of Kidron, unto the corner of the horse gate toward the east, shall be holy unto the Lord. It shall not be plucked up nor thrown down any more forever. The landmarks that Jeremiah gives are landmarks that have been identified. And the current suburbs of Jerusalem already extend to those boundaries. This prophecy points beyond that to a certain amount of security for the future of Jerusalem. Because in those days, security came by having the walls. Well, now there's security for Jerusalem, which is going to learn to trust God for its protection. Now we find the children of Israel are still building walls today, aren't they? There's no question about walls being built. Israel still hasn't arrived. But we read this in verse 8. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you. For he that touches you touches the apple of God's eye. And that's where we get that whole saying. He's the apple of his eye. It comes from the Bible. And he who touches Jerusalem touches the apple of God's eye. For behold, I will shake mine hand upon them, and they shall be a spoil to their servants. And ye shall know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me. The next vision that we look at is the vision of Joshua the high priest. We find it in Zechariah chapter 3. This vision records the acquittal and the restoration of the priesthood under Joshua the high priest. It also symbolizes, or it's a prevision of the atonement of Christ. It's a prevision of the atonement of Christ. The removal of the filthy garments, for example, from the high priest symbolizes the cleansing of Israel for future service. God has work for Israel upon the earth yet. And Israel is going to be cleansed for future service. But it also demonstrates to the Jewish remnant that God had not cast them off as a nation, but had cleansed them from their sin. The absence of a king from the throne of David discouraged many of the people, but Zechariah comforts the remnant with the prediction that the branch of David shall yet sit upon the throne. In Zechariah chapter 4, we see the vision of the olive trees. The temple appeared to be insignificant to Zerubbabel. And while it still appeared to be insignificant to him, this vision encourages Zerubbabel to go on in spite of the difficulties in building. The candlestick that we find in the vision represents the nation of Israel being filled with the Holy Spirit and enlightening the world. Regardless of what has happened with the nation of Israel down through the centuries, the nation of Israel is still a light to the world of the truth of God's Word. And it still points to the Lord Jesus Christ. The two anointed ones are Zerubbabel and Joshua, who, not by might nor by power, but by my Spirit, will overcome the opposition and complete the building of the temple. The next vision that we see is the vision of the flying roll. You know, in Missouri, there's a restaurant that's called the Home of the Throwed Rolls. And you know, the one who told me about it was my wife's aunt, who was from Arkansas, and so she had this terrible accent that made it so I could not understand what she's saying. And she said, well, it's the Home of the Throwed Rolls. Like, what? The Home of the Throwed Rolls. Finally, I figured out, yes, it's the Home of the Throwed Rolls. You want a roll like this, and they'll throw you one. You've got to catch it and eat it. Well, it's not talking about that with the flying rolls here, okay? this is not the Home of the Throwed Rolls. But we do have a vision of a flying roll here, but it's a vision of a scroll, like a sheet that's an unrolled wall map, about 30 feet long by 15 feet wide, inscribed with curses for those who swear and steal, or steal and swear, either way. This vision of this scroll, the scroll soars over top of the people, settling upon those who are guilty and consuming their houses. And of course, this reveals the reality and the swiftness of God's judgment that will fall upon individual sinners, especially those who steal and perjure themselves. Obviously, there was a problem that was going on in Judah even at that time with people that were stealing and perjuring themselves. The next vision that we see is the vision of the flying ephah in chapter 5, verses 5 through 10. The vision of the flying scroll was verses 1 through 4 of chapter 5. The seventh vision pictures an ephah. An ephah is a measuring basket that's slightly larger than a bushel basket. Now, how many of you know how large a bushel basket is? Most of you don't, do you? Well, it's probably about like this. It's about a bushel, roughly. And I learned that because when I was a kid, we used to buy the apples in bushel baskets, and my brother and I, when we were little, used those bushel baskets to feed the cattle. And we had to carry those with the grain, and my dad would tell us how many baskets of grain we had to bring out to the cattle, or silage that we had to bring out to the cattle. Well, this is a measuring basket that's slightly larger than a bushel. The sins that are associated with commercial preoccupation and false measures were gripping Israel at this time. So you not only had a problem with people stealing, of course, stealing is tied in with false measures, and perjuring themselves, that's all tied in with it as well. But you have problems with commercial preoccupation and false measures that were gripping Israel. The basket that he had here really must have been a larger basket, since it contained a woman inside it who is identified as wickedness personified. And this actually points toward civil, ethical, and religious evil. Not only must the wickedness that is in Israel be punished, but it must also be removed from the land. And so we find that two women with wings came and removed the wickedness to the plains of Shinar, which is Babylon. Now, Babylon is the cradle of civilization, but it does suggest that Babylon will become some kind of a commercial center once again. I've not had time to study it out, but it almost seems significant to me that Babylon is found in Iraq, and that millions and millions and millions of dollars are going to be pumped into Iraq to rebuild industry there. And it will become a commercial center once again. I don't know. Again, I haven't had time to look at it. I haven't had time to study it. But it is a thought that came through my mind as I'm going through this. We find that the woman of iniquity is moved by the angels to Babylon. Of course, Iraq today, as well as much of the Middle East, is known for its corruption and its crookedness. It's not just Iraq. I remember being in India a few years ago, and they were rebuilding a new highway. And they were making a four-lane highway, an interstate highway. Now, everything is done by hand, of course. And so here you have five people working, building this four-lane road by hand and shovels. But of the money that the World Bank gave to the nation of India for building that highway, half of it, according to people in India, was paid out in graft money. And so it's very, very common, not just in India, not just in the Middle East, but it's very common in a lot of the world that there's a lot of graft. You know, it's a cost of doing business. I know a businessman who wanted to put a telephone in Hyderabad. And so he determined that he was not going to pay any graft. So he called, asked to get the telephone put in. They said, well, you're going to have to go on the waiting list. So how long was the waiting list? I think it was like 5 years or something. And so before he finally ended up getting his telephone put in, he paid $15,000. He decided it was a tip. It's a cost of doing business in those countries. And you find that much of the world is like that. Don't be surprised if Iraq's going to be like that as well. We're going to pump billions of dollars in there. Other countries are going to pump billions of dollars into there. And we're going to have an economy that's going to, we could have an economy that's going to explode in the Middle East there. There are lots of other things exploding right now, though. The next vision is the vision of the four war chariots in chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. This last vision shows God's messengers going throughout the world, guarding Israel and carrying out God's justice when Christ is crowned as king. The chariots and horses are instruments of God's judgment. Now we find that Zechariah goes on to an object lesson in chapter 6, verses 9 through 15. He's commanded to put crowns of silver and gold on the head of Joshua, the high priest. This is significant because these crowns actually point toward the Messiah. The word Joshua, of course, is in the Old Testament. We find Joshua in the Hebrew, but it's the word Jesus in Greek, and it typifies the branch who will establish the millennial kingdom. Next, we go on and we find a section that deals with feasts. The children of Israel, of course, wanted to keep some kind of a semblance of religiousness. And so even while there was graft and corruption that was going on, they had to keep all of these different religious things. This section is written about 2 years after the previous visions of Zechariah. The temple was about half done in its about halfway in its construction at this point. For 70 years now, the children of Israel, since they had been brought into captivity, had been fasting on the 4th, 5th, 7th, and 10th months, mourning the destruction of the temple. Well, now the temple is being rebuilt, and so the people are now asking if God had sanctioned their feasts during the captivity, and now whether or not they should continue their feasts. There really wasn't much reality going on in many of their lives, but they wanted to keep the form. Zechariah's reply was that there was a good reason for their fast. Penitence for the disobedience and afflictions that came upon them as a result of disobedience. Now their fasts had become outward pretense to show their own holiness, and their feasts were really for their own pleasure. And so in a sense, I guess you find a form of Phariseeism that's going on with the children of Israel at that time. As we go on and look at chapters 9 through 14 in the book of Zechariah, we find that Zechariah talks about a universal ruler. He has two burdens that he presents. The first burden is concerning the oppressor, and the second burden is concerning the oppressed. Zechariah chapter 9 seems to predict Judah's struggle with Greece. And then it moves right on to the time of the Romans and to the triumphal entry of Christ into Jerusalem found in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, upon a colt, the foal of an ass. As you read these last chapters of the book of Zechariah, you're going to be impressed by the number of prophecies that you are going to find in there. There's so much that just fills in some of the gaps that we find. But the burden for the oppressed depicts future events, beginning with the siege of Jerusalem by the Gentile nations, of course, which was repulsed. Zechariah covers the Jews' final recognition of their Messiah in Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. When he writes this, I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications. And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one is in bitterness, that is in bitterness for his firstborn. You know, this is absolutely incredible, incredible passage. This is a great, great passage to use with Jehovah Witnesses in Zechariah chapter 12. Because in Zechariah chapter 12, you start with the burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord. Who's speaking? Well, it's the Lord. I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling. Who's speaking? That's the Lord. In that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. Who's speaking? It's the Lord. And that day, saith the Lord, I will smite every horse with astonishment. Who is it? It's the Lord. And so you go right on down through here. And it comes in verse 9, it says, It shall come to pass in that day, I will seek to destroy all nations that come against Jerusalem. Now, you say, who is that? Who is that that's speaking? It's the Lord. Well, look at verse 10. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications, and they shall look upon me. Who's speaking? It's the Lord. They shall look upon me whom they have pierced. And so this is an absolutely fabulous passage to be able to use with someone who questions the deity of Jesus Christ. The Jews are going to mourn for their sins. There will be a fountain opened in Jerusalem to cleanse them from their sins. There will be no more idolatry. And the voice of the false prophet will be silenced. The Messiah will lead his armies against the nations and shall rule over the earth in Jerusalem on David's throne. Zechariah chapter 14, verse 4 talks about the return of Christ, and his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof, toward the east and toward the west. And there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. Jesus Christ is going to come in. Of course, the Muslims have put their graveyards in front of the eastern gate of the city of Jerusalem because they know that Jesus would not go ahead and the Messiah would not go ahead and make himself dirty by going through a graveyard. Well, they're not going to have to worry about it. It's going to split. He's going to ride right up through that valley, right up into Jerusalem. And he's not going to even have to ride through the graveyard because that's all going to be split wide open, and the gate, the eastern gate there is going to be open as well. And I don't know if you can still do it, but I know that Pastor Scudder and I climbed all over the Mount of Olives. We spent almost a whole day on the Mount of Olives and by the Eastern Gate just going through there. And we went through catacombs and all kinds of stuff up on the Mount of Olives. It's really an incredible place. But what's going to happen is that Jerusalem will become the capital of the nations. And all the nations are going to go to Jerusalem yearly. Except for the Psalms, Zechariah has more prophecy about Christ's crucifixion than any other Old Testament book. Remember that. You're going to want to remember that. It has more prophecy about Christ's crucifixion than any other Old Testament book except the Psalms. The events he predicts includes Christ's triumphal entry, the betrayal for 30 pieces of silver, the purchase of the potter's field with that blood money, the treachery of his so-called friend, and the scattering of his disciples. And of course, you'll find the fulfillment of each of these prophecies in the New Testament. Finally, we get to the last book of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi. Malachi was a contemporary of Nehemiah. He prophesied between the second and third administrations of the governors of Jerusalem. The temple was in existence in his time, and he rebuked Judah for the same problems as Nehemiah did. Malachi was a teacher and debater who depended largely on argument and expostulation to arouse his hearers and to prove his assertions. The temple had been rebuilt, and the people's worship had become formal and selfish, with the people being unconcerned about the things of God. We'll take just a couple of moments here, and we'll look at the rebukes of Malachi. As a result of their formalism in worship, Malachi rebukes the Jews for their national sins. First, the Jews were offering animals for sacrifices, which were so diseased and blemished that they would not have dared to give them to their governor to try to pay their taxes. This is an insult to God, who had brought destruction to both Edom and Israel, but had only restored the Jews. It's an insult to the God who had brought destruction to both Edom and Israel, but had restored only the Jews. Second, the priests who were responsible to lead the people in God's ways had become so debased that the word priest had become a word of contempt to the people. Kind of like today, isn't it? I have talked to people who are very, very involved in the Catholic Church who have relatives who are priests, and they say they don't even like to wear their cleric collars anymore because people look down on priests so much. Well, these are the true priests of God that were being looked down, or supposed to be the true priests of God, and they were false as well. Third, the Jews were divorcing their wives to marry heathen women. This is a double sin because it was also disastrous in raising the next generation of children, and it was fatal to the worship of Jehovah. The people also looked, of course, at the prosperity of the nations, the heathen nations that were surrounding them, and they reasoned, since that those nations were more prosperous, there was no use in serving God. Malachi reminds the people that the coming day of judgment will reveal whether it pays to serve God. I think it was John R. Rice that had a message that was titled, Payday Someday. And I think it's important for all of us as Christians to remember that. Fourth, Malachi accused the people of robbing God by not paying their tithes. Because the tithes are God's property, to which the giver had no right. The people are challenged to test God and see whether God will bless them when they tithe. Once again, the national skepticism about God's promises was demonstrated by their refusal to tithe, since they believed tithing was a waste of money. And Malachi once again reminds the people that the end is going to show whether it was worth tithing or not. Four times, sandwiched between his rebukes for the prevailing sins of his day, such as tainted sacrifices, idolatrous marriages, divorces, the failure to tithe, Malachi sweeps the people toward the day of the Lord. Malachi's advice is also good for us. Keep your eyes on the future. In his closing chapter, Malachi predicts the return of Elijah before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. Christ indicated that John the Baptist could have fulfilled this prophecy if he would have been received. Like the one he announced, John was also rejected. Christ declared after the death of John that Elijah would come and restore all things. Since that prophecy must yet be fulfilled, many believe that Elijah will be one of the two witnesses who will appear during the tribulation. The Old Testament is a story of man's failure in which the hope of the Redeemer appears as the rays of sun at dawn. Malachi closes with this hope given in the last chapter. Malachi chapter 4, verse 2, "But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings." And so we finished that Old Testament survey course that seemed like it was going to go on forever. But for me, it's been an exciting study. I hope it's been as exciting for you as for me. I know it's been refreshing for me to go back through the Old Testament like this. I pray that God really blesses it and uses it in your life as well. Any questions? Number 3. Okay. I think I did skip that one, didn't I? This makes him a distant relative to King Josiah. 74. Zechariah chapter 2, verses 8 and 9 points to God's protection and jealousy over Jerusalem. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.